I got to be honest, folks. I cannot quite figure out what Ellen Goodman is trying to say in a recent column under Society. Where is feminism headed? Usually when I read Ellen Goodman, it's pretty clear her views on matters feminist. She's an ardent feminist. She seems to have no problem with the agenda, although she saw a movie, Mona Lisa Smile. Some of you may have seen it as well. And she says it makes her wonder what women want, and it makes her wonder where feminism is headed. Now, I don't know if she wants more of the same or a different direction, but it's a good question, and it deserves an answer, doesn't it? Where is feminism headed? Maybe the best way to answer that is to first talk about where it came from, where it's been. We'll do all that here in the first half hour of Issues, Etc. Our guest, Carolyn Graglia, she joins us in just a moment. She's author of the book Domestic Tranquility, A Brief Against Feminism. She'll join us from her home in Austin, Texas. Now, after that, we'll be spending the remainder of this first hour with two guests. First of all, Joseph Starrs, director of the American Life League's Crusade for the Defense of the Catholic Church, on the occasion of St. Louis Archbishop-elect Raymond Burke's being in the news here in St. Louis and nationally because he has drawn the line about who can receive communion when it comes to lawmakers who are pro-choice and yet still calling themselves Roman Catholic. He has not said he will do the same thing when he is Archbishop here in St. Louis, which he will be here at the end of the month, but there's no reason to believe that he's going to change course either. We'll be talking with Joseph Starrs a little later in this hour about that, and Father Robert Hart will join us, vicar of St. Andrew's Chapel in Easton, Maryland. Abortion in the case of rape. We'll be talking about a story and two women very close to his heart, his wife and his daughter, and the issue of abortion and rape. In the second hour of the program, David Mills joins us. He's editor of Touchstone Magazine. We're going to be talking about abortion ideology. Everyone gets to be an ideologue when you disagree with them, right? Those people I disagree with, they're ideologues. But there's ideology. There's ideas on both sides of the debate. Some of the ideas are good. Some of them aren't. And we'll also be talking with David Mills about an official news agency for the Episcopal Church USA, and the propaganda that is often put forth on the issue of the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church USA. After that, we'll be talking with Eric Pement of Moody Bible Institute about Michael Jackson and the Nation of Islam. Why would the beleaguered pop star, the king of pop, suddenly decide that he wants to join the Nation of Islam? What about that organization appeals to him now? In the last half hour of the program, open lines for your questions and your comments. Recently on the morning show here on AM 850 KFUO, Dr. Jeff Gibbs had a few things to say about, well, what George Barna pointed out, and that is that half of Protestant pastors in the U.S. fail to hold a minimal biblical worldview. We'll see what Dr. Gibbs has to say, and I'd like your reaction to it as well in the last half hour of the program, open lines. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Carolyn Graglia is a regular guest here on Issues, Etc. She's a graduate of Cornell and Columbia Law School. She left a promising and successful legal career to care for her family, and she's author of the book Domestic Tranquility. She joins us from Austin. Carolyn, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Good to be here again.
Carolyn, Ellen Goodman, it can be counted on as a nationally syndicated columnist to toe the feminist line, but she seems somewhat perplexed about the direction of feminism lately, especially in her latest column, Where is Feminism Headed? What's the problem here?
Well, in that column, she is discussing the movie Mona Lisa Smiles, right? And the problem really isn't faced up to in that movie. And I think that what Ellen Goodman is very much aware of is that today so many of the women who followed feminism's directives and pursued careers, sometimes got married, sometimes were unable to, find that when they have successful law practices or medical practices, they are missing out on what they've decided is the most important thing in life, and that's a good marriage and a family. And Alan Goodman is aware of that, and she is recognizing, I think, that in Mona Lisa Smiles, they're really not facing up to the problems of women today at all, and they're misrepresenting what it was like in the 1950s in college. Feminists have always really falsified reality, as I say in my book, Domestic Tranquility. They misstate the facts about the past. And in that movie, Mona Lisa Smiles, they describe, Julia Roberts describes colleges in the 1950s, like Wellesley, where she's supposed to be teaching, as designed to groom elite women to become elite wives. That just is not true, and it really degrades the efforts of women in colleges in the 1950s. We studied very hard, we worked very hard, and we were very successful. And the fact that most women then decided it was better to get married young and have their children young didn't mean that they hadn't been good college students and that they hadn't learned a lot in college. They may well have learned more than the women who today avoid getting married and having children until it's too late.
How does it serve the purposes of feminism today to paint a picture of the 50s and to the decades prior to that as, you know, women simply being churned through a mill, either the family or society, or in this case, even college, just to make better wives and housekeepers? Why does it serve their purposes to play upon that stereotype?
Well, it's interesting. It serves their purposes because what they still want to do is to convince women, despite all the evidence of the deterioration in society that we have witnessed over the past three decades, they still want to convince women that the most important thing to do is to establish your career. And therefore, they want to distort the facts about the past because they want women today to think that the only reason that their mothers didn't put them in daycare and have full-time careers was because they didn't have opportunities. And that is just pure baloney. Women have always had opportunities if they wanted to take them, but in past generations, the women who didn't pursue the careers and stayed home as full-time wives and mothers were respected by the culture. And because they were respected by the culture, it was easy for them to say no to the careers. But today, full-time wives and mothers are not respected. That's one of the major points in my book, is that it takes a lot of courage to be a full-time wife and mother because the role has been so degraded by the feminist movement.
One of the things that Goodman decries in her column, later in the column, and it's often put in terms of the glass ceiling. Women will climb the ladder and then find the glass ceiling above which they can see men continuing to ascend. But there's an invisible barrier put there by the culture and the business and everything else that keeps them from rising any higher. But Ellen Goodman seems to have run into, well, reality.
Right.
And that being a reality of feminists making, she talks about it in these terms. I'd like your reaction. She says, women no longer face a conflict between graduate school and marriage, but the crunch often comes 10 years later between a 24/7 profession and 24/7 motherhood. Then she goes on to say the passion of the women's movement was to empower women to make their own lives. But what are the limits? A 70-hour work week, child care, double jeopardy economy, the fact that these discussions are still largely by and about and between women. What is she trying to say? What's the problem?
Well, she is recognizing and facing up to the fact that was pointed out very forcefully in as a cover story in the New York Times Magazine section in October, and they called it the opt-out revolution. And it was written about all the women who have decided that they are going to leave very high-powered careers. Most of the women they interviewed have been lawyers or investment bankers, and they had all decided that this was not what they wanted in their life because they wanted to stay home and raise their children at home. And I think Ellen Goodman is recognizing that this is a fact today. Now, many of the feminists are not recognizing it, and they will not concede that these women are really doing what they want to do. That's why they always talk about the glass ceiling, as if there are barriers that women are facing just because they're women. In a sense, that is true, but it's only because the women choose to recognize a barrier. That is a woman who says, I am perfectly happy with having my children raised completely by other people, and I'll see them briefly in the evening, I'll see them briefly in the morning, and I'm going to work just as hard as my colleagues in the workplace, male colleagues. Well, they don't face a glass ceiling. They don't. Women, I mean, the bottom line is what counts to employers. And if a woman is willing to sacrifice time with her children, time with her home and her husband in order to work as hard as the employer wants, there's no glass ceiling. But the point is, women, many women recognize that they're different from men. They have a yearning to be with their children. And they are willing to, as this article is called, the opt-out revolution, they are willing to opt out. What feminists have never wanted to recognize is that women always knew that they had this yearning. The reason that most of my classmates at Cornell in the 1950s didn't go on to graduate school, many of us did, but I'd say the majority did not. The majority got married right after college, and they were probably right. They were able to have more children than I was, because it took me a while to realize that I really wanted to have kids and stay home and be a mommy and a full-time wife. But these women weren't discouraged from going to graduate school. They were bright enough to go, and they could have gone, but they knew they had this yearning for children. And women today are finally getting the courage to stand up and say this is true. I was just talking to a law school professor the other day who told me that the brightest woman in one of his classes told him, and they had just taken a midterm, and she'd gotten the highest mark, and she said, I'm dropping out of law school. She said, this just isn't fun, and I just want to get married and have kids. And I was so happy to hear that she had the courage to say that, rather than go on and plug away and maybe not get married and never be able to have kids. So this is a good thing that's happening, and it's good that someone like Ellen Goodman is recognizing it.
Goodman has a hard time. I think maybe in years past, feminists like Goodman would have said such a woman is essentially a traitor against
right.
the cause. But she has a hard time doing that because she recognizes herself that if this is what women want, that was supposed to be, I think, what feminism was all about in the first place.
Right.
Letting women do what they want.
Well, that certainly is what feminists say. Actually, the fact is they never, ever meant it. Because in order to make it possible for women to leave the workplace, they have to have all sorts of protections from society. And one of those protections is to reform no-fault divorce, and I've discussed that on your program before. Well, the people who are most opposed to reforming no-fault divorce are feminists. And I quote there in my writings, I quote the feminist arguments, and these are the legal feminists, the ones who actually are making the laws. the ones who fought for no-fault divorce. They'll say, we cannot reform no-fault divorce because this will just encourage women to leave the workplace. They admit, and I can quote you, feminist writings that say, if given a choice, many women, probably most, would prefer to leave the workplace and raise their children at home. And if we reform no-fault divorce to give them protection in divorce courts, this will simply encourage them to do this, and women really should be working in the workplace.
So no-fault divorce in that case, admittedly, on the part of feminists, is a ploy to keep women in the workplace, often against their will.
Oh, definitely, definitely. In fact, the woman, she's extremely important in the legal profession. She was the one who worked on the first California divorce, no-fault divorce law, which was the groundbreaking law. And she has a, I quote her in one of my articles, she says, women must learn that their unique role in reproduction ends with childbirth, and that like men, they should pursue independent lives outside the family. Now, this is not about choice at all. She is saying women should be forced by the laws of the country to work outside the family and put their kids in daycare.
I'm going to come back very briefly to this whole opt-out revolution terminology that you were talking about before from the weekly news magazine. That alone also seems a little fishy to me, opting out as though the natural course would have been to go into the workplace.
Exactly.
It seems the woman is opting in for what it is she really wants to do.
Right.
Marriage and family.
Yeah, well, that's a very good point. I mean, it's fascinating because this is an article that, we think it's in the New York Times, and you think of the New York Times as always following a feminist line. And yet this article really exposes the real problems facing women today who are trying to follow the feminist line and decide they can't do it. And yet when they choose a title, you're right, they choose a title that tries to, in a way, criticize these women. They're telling you all these women are leaving the workplace, they're giving up what feminists have always said is the greatest things you can aspire to. They're giving it all up, so they use the phrase opt out as if they're doing something that is unnatural.
Or it sounds like they're just staying home and dawdling away their time.
Exactly. Right. And which is what this is what homemakers have to fight all the time. I mean, and it's a fascinating thing. And even people who have recognized, it was really bad. What feminism did to us wasn't good because here we are, many of us are divorced, raising children alone, we're working hard all the time, and life hasn't worked out for us. And I can quote you from ex-feminists who write this way, and then at the same time they'll say, but we don't advocate that women retrogress to the brainless housewives of the 50s. Well, but how can they call us brainless housewives of the 50s? I was a housewife of the 50s, and I certainly was not brainless. We were not. And this is something that you have to fight all the time because it's going to be too difficult for women to leave the workplace when they're being referred to as brainless housewives. It's very hard to maintain a sense of dignity and feel that you have status in the society when that's the way the media will present you.
Carolyn Graglia, thank you very much for your time and being our guest on Issues Etc.
Well, I enjoyed it.
Carolyn Graglia is a graduate of Cornell and Columbia Law School. She left a promising legal career to care for her family. She's author of the book Domestic Tranquility, A Brief Against Feminism. She joined us from Austin, Texas. Now, if you'd like to get more information on the book, and I highly recommend it, called Domestic Tranquility by Carolyn Graglia, you can go to the website for the publisher, Spence Publishing, at www.spencepublishing.com. That's www. www.spencepublishing.com, or you can call Spence Publishing at 1-888-SPENPUB. That's 1-888-SPENPUB. As we go into the bottom of the hour and into this second half of this first hour, we're going to be talking with Joseph Starrs. He's director of American Life League's Crusade for the Defense of the Catholic Church. Now, church discipline doesn't often make the headlines, but it sure is in St. Louis. And given the fact that a lot of Roman Catholic lawmakers are pro-choice over against the expressions of their church, the biggest headline has been St. Louis Archbishop-elect Raymond Burke's activity when he was Archbishop in La Crosse, and worry here in St. Louis about what he might do when he comes here. Will he be writing letters to lawmakers saying you cannot have communion if you are still pro-choice? Look, it heartens me to see a churchman who says, look, this is what the church teaches. If you will claim the name Roman Catholic, then you cannot consistently behave and act and speak and vote pro-choice. Joseph Starrs, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about the new ad, You Can't Be Catholic and Pro-Abortion.
Sure. Well, on Thursday, the 31st anniversary of the Roe versus Wade decision, we're coming out with a full-page ad that will be running in national papers, the Washington Times specifically. That honors Bishop Raymond Burke for taking a strong stand on behalf of life, for finally confronting Catholic pro-abortion politicians with the full authority of his office. You know, other bishops have said good things, have even confronted individual politicians who support anti-life legislation, but Bishop Burke has issued a canonical notice, an official decree that covers all present and future pro-abortion Catholics. And so he's really taken a strong stand, and he's, as I said the other day, he's leapt out of the foxhole, so to speak.
Is he entirely unique in going this far in not only exercising the authority of his office as bishop, but also on this issue with Roman Catholic lawmakers who are pro-abortion? You got 1 minute before the break.
I think he is definitely unique. He's there have been other bishops, like I said, who've done individual cases and who've done. There was a bishop from Louisiana who excommunicated some segregationists back in the early 50s and 60s. But this is the first time that any bishop has done anything that with these kind of guts, for lack of a better way to put it. He's really stepped out in front, and he's really taken a lead hopefully other bishops will follow.
When we come back from this break, we'll continue our conversation with Joe Starrs, director of American Life League's Crusade for the Defense of the Catholic Church. Now, in reading the reaction to this in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, letters to the editor, it's raised in several of those letters, well, I think Bishop Burke needs to reread his civics textbooks, or maybe he needs to check again on the separation of church and state. The first time I heard this objection, it struck me as odd. I don't know why it did, but it struck me as odd. Does a bishop have a right to hold his communicants accountable for their views? When we come back, we'll get Joe's reaction to some of those letters to the editor in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on the issue of St. Louis Archbishop-elect Raymond Burke.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The psalmist writes in the 44th Psalm, "Awake, O Lord, why do you sleep? Rouse yourself. Do not reject us forever. Why do you hide your face and forget our misery and oppression?" Have you ever felt a little like the psalmist, that God had become your enemy? You'll find an in-depth study of the complaint psalms in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January, titled, When God Becomes My Enemy. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, for more information on this book, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $19.99 plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040. Is it a sin to complain to God? And if God is omniscient, can he be persuaded to change his course of action? Find out with the book, When God Becomes My Enemy, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for January. Issuesetc.org or 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute lets you pray for Spain, which is having a dramatic shift in its population. In several years, Muslims will likely influence many aspects of society. The number of Muslim immigrants settling to work in Spain has increased in recent years. Muslims also value families. There are about 6 children per Muslim family, while Spanish mothers give birth on an average to fewer than 2 children. The mission agency Operation Mobilization now has outreaches to Muslims within Spain. This year, OM needs short-term missionaries to help the dedicated career missionary families. Activities include home Bible studies and working with city organizations to help some of the poorest families in certain places. Pray for Spain, a country where up to 8,000 towns and cities have no gospel witness. Get more prayer information by visiting the Operation Mobilization website at usa.om.org. That's usa.om.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Sunday's Washington Post ran a front-page story about the lack of civility in politics. Said one congressman, "I think we've hit an all-time low." It reminded me of a conversation several years ago. I was standing with a veteran Republican activist who was talking with the lawyer who defended President Clinton during his impeachment trial. They spoke about just this subject, lamenting how things had become more divisively partisan. Their conversation was sincere, demonstrating a tie that binds us together as humans and Americans, something greater than the partisan disputes that divide us. There is civility in Washington, but it doesn't sell newspapers or deliver customers to TV news sponsors. In today's abundance of political news, the Iowa caucuses, the State of the Union speech, New Hampshire, the media flitter to the divisive like moths flittering to light. We may have to suffer with it, but we do not have to imitate it. Your smoldering grudges, your bitter disagreement with a family member, your anger at a business associate or a competitor, isn't there a tie that binds? God made that person just as he made you. God loves that person just as he loves you. God is no respecter of persons.
There's people in your life that really don't need anything new, but you still want to honor them on their special occasions. Well, you could do it by becoming an AM 850 KFUO Day Sponsor. Birthdays, anniversaries, whatever you're celebrating, do it with a day sponsorship. You'll get 5 announcements on that special day. For more information, call Janelle Flerke at 1-888-930-4438 and become an AM 850 KFUO Day Sponsor and help support the ministry.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., the Iowa caucuses. We'll be talking with Dr. Jeff Waltz, political science professor at Concordia University in Wisconsin. We'll also discuss the president's State of the Union speech with Congressman John Shimkus. He will be there in the chamber this evening with the other members of Congress and the Senate, where the president will address the nation. I'll be watching, taking notes, and tomorrow we'll discuss it with Congressman Shimkus. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. Joe Starrs is our guest of the American Life League's Crusade for the Defense of the Catholic Church. We're talking about Raymond Burke, the Archbishop-elect here in St. Louis, who'll be installed on the 26th of January, if I'm not mistaken,
Correct. And
his actions that he was taking in La Crosse when he was bishop there. Can we expect, based upon what we know of Bishop Burke's character and his conviction, that he will be undergoing or undertaking similar actions in St. Louis sooner or later?
Well, I heard a radio interview that the bishop did up in La Crosse, and he was asked that very question, and he responded, yes. So, according to him, he fully intends to do the same thing in St. Louis.
The objection that is often raised, and it's raised in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in some letters to the editor, in two of them, in fact, is that this somehow violates the separation of church and state. How do you respond to that?
Sure. Well, my first response to that's an intellectually bankrupt argument, because what we're talking about here when it comes to abortion and euthanasia, it's a human rights issue. It's not a religious issue. This is a commonly held belief throughout the centuries that human life is sacred. And so politicians who say it's a matter of separation in church and state, they're throwing that out because people don't challenge it. And I challenge it, and pro-lifers and Christians across the country should challenge it. How is the protection of human life a religious issue? You know, that there is a thing called the separation of church and state. But these, the argument that they're throwing out, it doesn't really, the light of day doesn't, you know, doesn't flow on that argument. It just really doesn't follow logically. This is a human rights issue, and every church, every institution has certain rules if you want to belong to it, and the Catholic Church thinks that protecting human beings is pretty important. And so if you want to call yourself a Catholic, there are certain non-negotiables, and protecting innocent human life is a non-negotiable.
How would you respond to the argument that an elected official, since he is elected to represent the entire body who elected him, has to, of necessity, withhold his own personal opinions, including tenets of his religious faith?
Right. Well, I would throw that right back and say, can you imagine someone saying, well, I'm personally opposed to segregation, but since the more people in the South support it, I have to support it. You know, a person's conscience should form their decision, should inform their decision. And again, I think this is a red herring argument that sort of takes responsibility off the politician and says, well, you know, the people want it, so that's what they get. I don't buy it. You know, if you're gonna call, again, and this goes back to, what are you as a Christian? What are you as a Catholic? Do you support the teachings of the church on critical issues? We're not talking about whether you want altar girls or whether or not the priest should wear black. This is a fundamental of life and death. And so I don't buy this. I represent so many people. They're, you run on principle and belief, and people will either elect you or not elect you on what you stand for.
Kurt is on the line, calling from Edwardsville. Kurt, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi. I have a question regarding former Senator Paul Simon. Was he ever excommunicated in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? Obviously, he was pro-abortion. And my question is, in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, who does the excommunicating? Is it the elder? Is it the elders, the pastor, or the district president?
It's two good questions there, Kurt. And just so you understand, Joe, I am a minister in the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, and that's why the question
Okay.
Is posed in those terms. First of all, in answer to your second question, the excommunication formally is done. It is a decision of the congregation and the pastor, the individual congregation and the pastor. It is carried out by the pastor. He is the one who actually bars from communion the person who has who is living unrepentantly, or in this case, holding views unrepentantly against the Word of God. Now, was Paul Simon ever excommunicated? Not to my knowledge. In fact, the best knowledge I have says that he pretty much got to kind of go around being pro-choice and being a very vocal and public critic
Sure.
of his church's position on the issue of abortion and other things, and nobody really laid a finger on him for some reason, and he died before anyone had enough good sense to do something about it. Sad, very, very sad to say. Joe, I do wonder whether or not a misimpression might be left by all the news surrounding Raymond Burke and his actions in La Crosse, and that being that, well, the vast majority of Roman Catholic lawmakers and elected officials are pro-choice. Is that true?
Well, put it to you this way. We've identified 510 pro-abortion Catholic politicians in the United States on the state and federal level. In the U.S. Congress, right now, there's 71 or 70 pro-abortion Catholic politicians. So in terms of percentages, you know, I don't know. But our bottom line is that's far too many, and they have far much influence when it comes to promoting what the Pope calls the culture of death. And we think it's time for bishops of all denominations to stand up, just like Bishop Burke has done.
In that connection, and finally, Joe, can we expect other bishops to follow Burke's lead here?
I think so. I think we can expect other bishops, other pastors, Lutheran, Baptist, Protestants of all denominations, evangelicals, and, yes, other Roman Catholic bishops as well. Bishop Alfred Hughes from New Orleans last week came out with a very strong statement, and not only did he say you should not be receiving communion if you're a pro-abortion politician, but if you vote for a pro-abortion politician, you're participating in a grave sin. So again, there's another bishop who has stepped out. Now, real quick, I don't know how much time we have left here, but the bishops have appointed a task force of seven bishops to look into the problem of pro-abortion politicians, and these seven bishops will draft guidelines for the entire body of bishops on how to deal with him. So hopefully the Burke decision will serve as a model for the rest of the Catholic bishops and the rest of the Christian leadership in the country.
Joe Starrs, thank you very much for being our guest on the program.
You're welcome.
Joe Starrs is director of America Life League's Crusade for the Defense of the Catholic Church. Look for that in the paper, full-page ads in national papers. He is, if you want to go to their website, very easy to remember. This is an easy one, www.all.org. That's the website for American Life League and the Crusade for the Defense of the Catholic Church, www.all.org. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to be talking with Father Robert Hart. He's vicar of St. Andrew's Chapel in Easton, Maryland. We're going to be talking about what is often called the hard case, often called the exception. I remember a time when I could have said very, probably sheepishly, but with some definition, that I was pro-life, except. I always felt a little fishy about the except part. And I'll be quite honest with you, until I started hosting this radio program, started thinking these things through a little more carefully, and started considering what the real implications of a genuinely pro-life position is, where life begins, when it begins, and in whom it begins. It wasn't until that I started to drop the except. Now I can say I'm pro-life. No exceptions. Period. It's not easy because there are so many people out there who are pro-life except rape. What about that one? Let's just go for the hardest issue. Father Robert Hart has authored an article in the latest issue of Touchstone magazine titled Her Mother's Glory. Father Hart, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, thank you, Todd.
Tell us your story. Why this title, Her Mother's Glory?
Well, the title actually was I suppose selected by David Mills, but I would agree with it. If you think of glory in the old King James sense of that which you may boast, I mean, boast rightly. He that glorieth, let him glory in the Lord. And I would say that this was the hard decision that my wife, when she was a young single girl. In her early 20s, the hard decision she had to make based on her principles as a believing Christian person, raised as a Catholic, and who knew her Bible and the teachings of why all life is sacred, suddenly realizing here she's been raped. She didn't choose to be in the situation that caused her to be pregnant. She didn't have financial means. She didn't have a husband. She didn't have the ability to go out and get a good job. But she, at that point, she didn't have any education really beyond high school. But she had those firm convictions that all life is sacred. And as a result, she was able to withstand all of these terrible pressures and basically make her decision based on that and the natural love that really is in the heart of every mother who gives into that, if God made them.
According to the story you recount in Touchstone magazine, she did have to run something of a gauntlet of social workers and others saying, look, the honorable thing to do would be to abort this child.
Well, the honorable, of course, you're referring to my own way of writing. You know, in the old days, if a man got a woman pregnant, he did the honorable thing. He married her. And all the social pressure was on him to do that. As a result of what is called women's rights, the woman now has to do what society would call the honorable thing, which we would, of course, not call that. The woman has all the burden on her and all the risks, all the health risks and dangers of abortion, and she's almost expected to go through with this. So basically the pressures that were on her were being put on her by many of the people around her, by social workers who should, I guess, really shouldn't have even been involved, but basically the pressures on her was that she really ought to get an abortion, and after all it was due to rape and it would be best for her. And you know, as the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel, as it says in Proverbs, some who undoubtedly were telling her it would be best for the child, as if being killed is ever the best for anybody. She withstood that.
Now, one of the objections, actually, to tell you the truth, the one that swayed me on this eventually to remove all exceptions from my own pro-life views, and it wasn't easy to do because it seems so compassionate to mm-hmm. have those exceptions in there. And
right.
I finally had to dispense with the idea that it was compassion at all to leave a baby dead for any reason whatsoever. But the one that swayed me was, look, rape is a crime, a terrible crime, but it simply does not do to punish both the woman and the child for a crime neither of them committed.
Well, I'm glad you put it that way, because although some people undoubtedly think of abortion as an easy way out, the price that women pay psychologically after they've had one, the price that they may even pay in terms of their health if they survive the abortion, and there's no reason to believe that because abortion is legal that it's safe, it's not safe, but if they survive it, there's going to be all kinds of psychological problems to follow, possibly other medical problems to follow. So to say it's compassionate is very wrong. And also, I believe that when we confuse compassion with the notion that we should always give people the easy way out, that we deprive people of the chance to rise to an occasion, to live up to a challenge, and it becomes like that moment of cowardice on the battlefield that ruins a person for the future. It is better for the person in a position like that to face the hardship, to face the trouble, to make the difficult decision, and then it's very easy compared to, well, it's not always easy, let me rephrase, it's easier to live with yourself when you know you've done the right thing. So it's never compassionate to tell someone, take the easy way out, take the coward's way out. That's not compassion. That's condemning them to a terrible future.
I'm trying to put myself in the position of you and in the position of your wife as well, and I'm wondering whether or not the circumstances of your daughter's conception can ever be very far from your mind.
Actually, it's always far from my mind. I mean, as I said in the article, things jolt me back into the memory of it. Because when you have a child, when you accept the child into your heart, whether from the time you start to care for a child, to feed the child, to take care of the child in any way, that's simply your child. An adopted child, a naturally born child. I have three sons who are mine by nature, and then my daughter, mine by adoption. It's always far from my mind. Something has to remind me of that for me to even think about it. That, I believe, is just part of human nature.
How do you respond to the person who says, look, the woman's going to have to relive the circumstances of the rape every birthday or something along those lines, and it's too grave of a thing to ask a woman to do this?
From what I've learned living with my wife, that is nonsense. First of all, not nonsense on your part, I mean the question you're setting up.
Certainly.
If they go through the abortion, they simply have two traumas now instead of one. If they have the child, as my wife did, they have a child. It is, you know, the natural psychological way that women are made is to bond with the child before the child's born. And in my own wife's case, I can honestly say that having this child was the healing. She had had a trauma, but it wasn't a trauma anymore. Now she's a mother, and now she has a baby, and now that baby is her daughter, and every birthday is simply her daughter's birthday. And I don't think that makes my wife an unusual person at all. I think that, again, as I say, is human nature. When the child is in your life and in your heart, that's simply your child. That's all that you are even conscious of anymore. And I can say that with my wife. I mean, there's no trauma. There's no remembering. She'd probably remember the rape a lot more if she had had an abortion, because now she'd simply have this empty, horrible experience followed by another horrible experience and no healing.
I was speaking recently, Father Hart, to a group of pastors up north, and I asked as something of a diagnostic question. We were talking about worldviews, and we're getting to what Wesley Smith calls the culture of death.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked the question, is a woman always better off having her baby? And it's a hard question to answer because, well, one of the pastors said, well, I don't know, but the baby always is. And I thought that was a good answer, but I wanted to press toward a positive answer to that question. And that being for this reason, Father Hart, it is God who gives life through human conception. And it's hard for me to believe the God I find in Holy Scripture would enter into that, would bring life into a woman's womb ever by accident, ever without fully committing himself to the new life he has created there. And if God would do this in this way, it's hard for me to say that the woman would ever not be better off having her baby. She might have to forego things, of course, but she will always be better off.
Well, babies always present a temporary inconvenience, and death always presents a permanent end. So anyone should weigh first of all, the temporary inconvenience, which a baby is, to the permanent death of the baby. I mean, it's not a very equal comparison. But yes, the woman, I believe, is always better off if she goes ahead and has the baby, and because that's her nature. Her nature is to be a mother. Her nature, once the baby's in the womb, is to be bonded to the baby. Even though women are being taught to be callous and hard-hearted and told that this is what they should be able to do without any pangs of conscience, the fact of the matter is, their nature is such that they should always indeed have the baby for their own sake, as well as just for the fact that it's right, because psychologically they're going to harm themselves otherwise. They bonded with a baby, but they don't have the baby. Miscarriages are painful enough to most women, but abortion adds to it the fact it was a matter of choice. So it's never a compassionate thing to say to the woman, go ahead and kill the baby. Yes, and also, I would say, you said, because God commits himself to every life, God is the author of all life, no matter how that life is conceived. God commits himself, and of course, the person who has faith, the woman who has faith in God as her father, and therefore as the one who will be the father of this baby, you know, that you will raise, hopefully in that same faith to be a Christian. Certainly, if she has faith in God, she's going to have a much easier time living with the right decision. If she has faith in God, she'll have a harder time living with the wrong decision, too.
How would you speak, then, to the person who is still pro-life except, who still says the abortion is wrong and should not be performed ever except in the case of rape or incest?
He's making an exception based on something that has absolutely no basis in anything that you could call a true pro-life view. If you believe that all life is sacred and the destruction of innocent human life is wrong, then you cannot make those exceptions. I mean, it's one thing to talk about an ectopic pregnancy in the fallopian tube. Obviously, you have no choice but to remove the fallopian tube, or else you're going to have two deaths. So, I mean, I don't want anyone thinking I'm trying to misuse what I'm saying. The decision to have an abortion would always be wrong for all the reasons we've already said. And the person who wants to make an exception is not pro-life. He's not. He just thinks he is.
Tell us finally, Father Hart, about when your daughter learned of the circumstances of her conception.
Actually, we were probably wrongly very reluctant to say anything for a long time. So the truth of the matter is, she was about 20 when she learned of it, you know, and there was absolutely no emotional reaction at all in any negative sense, and just basically a rather almost unobservable sign of relief. Not a very exuberant sign of relief, just a sign of relief. Now she knew, and we really probably should have told her sooner. And, you know, on an emotional level, it's not easy to bring up, and you just sort of let time go by, and you don't realize how old your kids are really getting until one day you look at them and say, oh, that's not a child anymore. It was just a relief for her, and she took it, you know, like it was just not very big news. And I think I know why that is. I think that's because she had always been made to feel that she's simply part of the family, and that we loved her, and that she was our daughter. And so it really wasn't a big jolt or a big shock to her at all.
So as you write in your Touchstone article, the circumstances of her conception did not matter. She is your child.
They don't matter. Once someone gets that out of their heads and stops making it an issue and realizes that the only issue now is how to care for the child, and if men will realize as well that they can love the baby that's been conceived that way, and as soon as you start to raise that child, that's your child, that becomes the only issue. That's the only thing that matters.
Father Robert Hart, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc. and for sharing that story with us as well and the readers of Touchstone.
Thank you very much.
Father Robert Hart, vicar of St. Andrew's Chapel in Easton, Maryland, and author of an article in the latest issue of Touchstone magazine titled, Her Mother's Glory. God is the creator of life. He didn't have a locker room full of little babies up in heaven that he sends down the chute when a child is conceived. He creates a new life through the agency, through human agency. A new, unique life. God is not an accidental creator. No conception is accidental because it's an act of God. God commits himself fully to the life he creates in the womb, regardless of the circumstances, the human circumstances surrounding the conception. He commits himself fully to the life he creates. And that's good news for the mother, and the father, and the baby. We'll be right back with the second hour of Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.